Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now a rare opportunity to speak with a retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice. John Paul Stevens, appointed by President Ford in 1975, served on the High Court until 2010, making him the third longest-serving justice when he retired 4 years ago at the age of 90. Justice Stevens now has a book in which he proposes six constitutional amendments. It's called Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. Justice Stevens, it is an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And I'll jump in on one of your constitutional proposals right off the bat. Change the Second Amendment on the right to bear arms to include the phrase when serving in the militia. Do you want the right to bear arms only for people in the military?
Well, I want the constitutional protection to apply only to that group. But the amendment wouldn't change the right of legislatures to do what they thought was appropriate.
So the federal guarantee would only be, the constitutional right would only be for people in the military, but each state could enact as broad gun rights as they choose? That's your point?
Yes, that's exactly right.
What would that change?
Well, it would change the laws in cities like New York and Washington that had more strict gun control than they can now have. It would protect the rights of legislatures rather than judges to be the final, to have the final word on what gun control policy should be.
So in Washington, D.C., for example, wanted to ban handguns, and the Supreme Court threw that out as a violation of the Second Amendment, you would give Washington, D.C. as a city that right back?
Yes.
What about the right to self-defense or the right to protect yourself against a tyrannical government?
Well, I don't think we have any tyrannical government.
Potentially,
in this country,
down the road.
Well, I think that it's not something that keeping a handgun at home will play a role in preventing tyranny in the United States.
And you want the First Amendment change to continue down your list of six amendments so that political spending cannot be taken to equal free speech. That would reverse a decision from when you were new on the bench, Buckley versus Vallejo from 1976, which equated campaign spending with speech. How did you vote on that at the time?
I was not on the court. The case was argued and decided after I arrived. I mean, it was decided after I arrived, and I read all the drafts of the opinions, but I did not vote in the case because it came just a few months ahead of my time.
I see. But you wish there was no such ruling.
I think it's an incorrect ruling. Justice Byron Wright wrote a dissent on that precise point, and a number of judges, such as Judge Skelly Wright of the D.C. Circuit, a very strong believer in wide interpretation of the First Amendment, thought it was a clear mistake.
Jim in Brick is calling in with a follow-up to your Second Amendment tweak. Jim, you're on WNYC with retired Justice John Paul Stevens. Hello.
Hi. Just reading the Federalist Papers, the militia as it stands now is sort of an amorphous entity. But earlier, Brian, you referred to the military. As I read the Federalist Papers, that the militia is to be a separate entity from a standing army that might be employed by a tyrannical government. The militia was supposed to be the safeguard to that standing army, in my reading.
Is that your understanding of the Federalist Papers, Justice Stevens?
Well, the Federalist Papers, of course, were written before the Constitution itself was drafted, and the Second Amendment came several years later. So I don't know exactly what he's referring to, but they're not directly relevant to the Second Amendment itself, which was designed to protect the state militias from being overpowered by a strong federal government.
Listeners, your calls for retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, a rare opportunity to ask a question directly of someone who held that position, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, on his book, Six Amendments, which proposes six new constitutional amendments. And you also want to amend the ban on cruel and unusual punishment to say, such as the death penalty. Now, when you were first on the bench, you voted to reinstate the death penalty in the United States, if I read my history right. Now you want it constitutionally banned as cruel and unusual punishment. Can you talk about your evolution on this issue?
Well, it takes a long chapter in a book. It's kind of hard to summarize in 30 seconds. But the answer is that at the time I voted on the issue back in 1976, Justice Powell and Justice Stewart and I, who were the key votes at the time, were expected there to be strong procedural protections that would give make sure that the prosecutor didn't have an unfair advantage in capital litigation. And over the years, the protections have worked the other way. They have given the prosecutor an added advantage in selecting jurors and introducing certain kinds of evidence at the penalty phase of death of penalty litigation that made the its scales of justice tip more in favor of the prosecution than the other way. And the other thing that has happened is that the need for the death penalty has been reduced tremendously by the availability of a sentence of incarceration without the possibility of parole, so that there is not a need for the penalty to prevent recidivism. And the other thing that has changed is that the other changes in the law that the court has adopted have protected the people who are convicted of capital crimes from having any painful punishment imposed on them, which is part of what the historic nature of the death penalty was, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth justification. That justification is no longer available because it's essential in order to impose the death penalty under the modern cases that the court has unanimously adopted. They cannot inflict the punishment in a way that causes any unnecessary pain to the inmate.
Which is why they went to something like lethal injection, despite that horrible botched execution the other day.
That's right.
But then if they don't in general feel pain, the inmates who are being put to death, if those things go right, and I think that's a matter of debate, but if they do not, then can you say that it's cruel and unusual punishment if pain is the standard rather than death itself being the standard?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that, but I'm not sure I really caught the question.
Well, is what makes – I'm trying to understand if for you what makes the death penalty cruel and unusual punishment is the suffering involved or the death itself, the killing itself?
Well, it's the risk that the punishment will be imposed on an innocent victim. That is, it's a real risk that's there, and it's an totally unnecessary to take that risk, because they can be put away for life without possibility of parole. And as long as there's a risk that an innocent person will be executed, and it's, as I say, it's a real risk because there have been dozens of people who have been found to have been innocent after they've been convicted by a jury, that we should not permit that possibility in our legal system.
Zeb in the West Village wants to follow up on your campaign finance amendment. Zeb, you're on WNYC with Justice Stevens. Good morning.
Morning, Brian. Morning, Justice Stevens. Justice, I'm curious, what you're proposing with the First Amendment changes, because, you know, personally, I believe that campaign finance and money in our political system is one of the biggest flaws, big interests, lobbying groups, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering how you propose that, the change for taking money out of this equals.
Well, there's nothing in the book that would take money out of the system entirely. The only thing that I really propose is that Congress and state legislatures would have the power to place limits on the amount of money that people can spend supporting political candidates. And the justification is particularly strong in parts of the country where the money is spent not to support the election of local candidates, but somebody in Wisconsin might want to spend money to defeat a candidate in Michigan, and which doesn't seem to be in line with the basic understanding of the framers of the Constitution, that elections should be run by voters, not by people not eligible to vote, whether corporate or non-resident.
And so the language that you wrote for this constitutional amendment you propose is, neither the First Amendment nor any other provision of this Constitution shall be construed to prohibit the Congress or any state from imposing reasonable limits on the amount of money that candidates for public office or their supporters may spend in election campaigns. Very straightforward, though then I guess there would be a lot of litigation as to what was a reasonable limit and what was an unreasonable limit.
I think that's right. There's that potential, but the actions would first have to be taken by the legislatures, and the question would be whether those limits were reasonable. And the need for that provision is to be sure that legislatures do not set the limits at such a low level that incumbents would have an unfair advantage.
You also have changed over time on the bench on affirmative action from more of a skeptic to more of a supporter. Can you describe your evolution on that?
That's not a subject that that's covered in the book, I don't think, is it?
No, but I'm curious.
Well, the big change is that early on, Congress enacted a statute that was colorblind. I thought the Civil Rights Act, in effect in 1976 when I came in the court, commanded legislatures to draw no distinctions on the basis of race. The court in the Bakke case held to the contrary. They said that it did permit affirmative action based on race. And after that, I thought the affirmative action should not be based on remedies for the many past wrongs that have been suffered by minority groups, but rather should focus on the future, deciding what would best serve both the majority and minority populations. And I wrote a number of opinions to that effect, one called Wygant against Michigan, in which they held that it was healthy for the student body to have the benefit of a black teacher as well as white teachers, and I thought that made a great deal of sense.
What did you think of the recent ruling allowing a statewide referendum to ban affirmative action at the University of Michigan?
Well, it's a very complicated case because it does not discuss the merits or demerits. Well, I guess Justice Sotomayor did in her dissent. But the issue in the case did not go to the wisdom or benefits to be obtained from affirmative action. The issue in the case turned on the method by which Michigan had made the decision to change the rules in the game. And there was about four or five different opinions discussing that issue, none of which focused on whether affirmative action is wise or unwise.
It's really whether something that's put in to some degree as a civil rights measure can be overturned by a popular vote in a white majority state.
Well, it's not quite that simple because it depends on the history that has preceded the particular issue. The cases that were discussed by the majority, by the different members of the court, all compared action taken by state lawmaking bodies that made the ability to create new protections for minorities, not necessarily affirmative action in education, but generally, whether those actions made it more difficult for minorities to get the legislative remedy that an earlier governmental body had tried to interpose. So it's a complicated, as my answer indicates, it's a fairly complicated question that's very difficult to try and summarize in a few seconds.
Retired Supreme Court Justice John, well, would you tell us how you would have voted?
No. I've hastily read the cases, but it's much too difficult a case to come out with a very simple answer.
Okay. Right now. Retired Justice John Paul Stevens, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. And Adam in the Cayman Islands, you're on WNYC with Justice Stevens. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Hello, Justice Stevens. It's an absolute honor to talk to you. You sound great. Thanks, Brian, for letting we the people talk to Justice Stevens.
It's your constitutional right.
You were appointed by a Republican, and a lot of your decisions have fallen on the liberal side. I was wondering if you got some backlash from either Gerald Ford himself or other Republicans privately. Did you get political flack from that? Were people verbally angry at you about that?
That's a question that I'm really happy to answer. I wish I could read it here, but I have a letter on the wall of my chambers, and it's actually in the other office right now, in which President Ford states that his appointment of me was one of the things he's most proud of. So I think he would agree with a good share of the votes I cast as a member of this court.
Do you think, though, that the voting records of yourself and Justice Souter, for example, appointed by the first President Bush, have led to the appointment of justices who are further to the right, like Roberts and Alito, to prevent another Justice Stevens, as it were, from surprising maybe not Gerald Ford, who is pretty moderate, but the Republican rank and file?
No, I don't. I don't think my tenure on the court had anything whatsoever to do with President Bush's decision to appoint very fine lawyers to fill the gaps that they had. Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts are both excellent justices.
Do you think the court has become more partisan than in the past, more justices concerned with furthering their partisan policy views rather than sticking to a nonpartisan standard of interpreting the Constitution?
No, I definitely do not. I would not suggest that either Justice Roberts or Justice Alito has been motivated by partisan concern.
Or from the other side?
Same thing. I think that each of the members of the court is doing the best job that he or she can to understand what the Constitution means and requires in particular cases.
Then why do they seem to line up so often in that way, where ultimately the justices appointed by Democrats are going to wind up with positions that seem to support affirmative action or support abortion rights or pick your issue, and those that are appointed by Republican presidents interpret the Constitution in ways that lead to the opposite policy ends?
Well, let me just give you one example in response to a question that could take a couple of hours to answer. Justice Kennedy was the key vote in the basic decision that refused to overturn Roe against Wade. And he, was, of course, appointed by President Reagan, and it has been the linchpin of the continuation of the constitutional.
But he's the exception. He's the eternal swing voter, the missing link.
Well, so there isn't the number of exceptions and the division on the court depends on the issue and involves many, many different issues, not just one or two that get such national attention.
Mohammed in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with retired Justice John Paul Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning, bro.
Oh, boy, you're breaking up so bad. Mohammed, I'm going to have to try you again in a minute unless you can clear up right now. Give it a shot. No. All right. I'm sorry, but I can't understand a word you're saying with your cell phone breaking up that bad. Justice Stevens, let me ask you about another issue that's not in the book. You came to the court shortly after Roe versus Wade, the right to an abortion based on privacy. Do you think Roe was correctly decided?
Yeah, Roe was definitely correctly decided, but not for the reasons set forth in Justice Blackmun's opinion, but rather for the reasons set forth in Justice Stewart's concurring opinion. which is much shorter and much more to the point. It identifies the basic right at stake as an incident of liberty, which is protected by the text of the Constitution. The discussions about privacy have tended to confuse debate on the issue and are most unfortunate.
Do you have an opinion on the current Mississippi case in the Court of Appeals in which the state effectively outlawed abortions indirectly by placing requirements on doctors that no doctors can actually meet?
I haven't read that. Haven't read the case, and I'm not familiar with it.
Robert in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Justice Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks. It's an honor to speak with His Honor. I've got a question about gerrymandering. I saw a statistic recently that after North Carolina got a veto-proof Republican majority for the first time since the Reconstruction in 2010, they did a redistricting of the congressional districts, and in the last election, although there was the statewide poll was 51% Democratic, 9 of 13 races went Republican. And then nationally, in the last election, the Democrats outpolled Republicans over a million votes and are still in the minority. I wonder if the justice could address whether there's a judicial remedy to this overdoing of redistricting and gerrymandering.
Robert, you have good instincts because apparently without knowing it, you have gone right to one of the constitutional amendments that Justice Stevens proposes in his book. Right, Justice?
That's exactly right. The remedy is really very simple. They should prohibit the drawing of very bizarre-shaped districts. They enforce, prohibit racial gerrymandering, very simply, by just simply not permitting these strange shapes to be allowed. And the same remedy that prohibits racial gerrymandering would also prohibit the political gerrymandering, which has precisely the consequence that you've described.
But how do you strike a balance between gerrymandering for good and gerrymandering for bad? Because when you talk about racial gerrymandering...
That's easy. I'll interrupt you. Say, neither one is good. There is no such thing as gerrymandering for good.
But gerrymandering for good, I mean, as some people see it, is in the Voting Rights Act, right, where majority-minority districts are created so they're not the minority in every congressional district in America.
Well, they may have been created as remedies for particular violations of law, but I don't think they are created in shapes that are so obviously improper and selected by a majority which is trying to preserve its power within a state jurisdiction.
Why shapes? I know people always come back to shapes in this. You want a district that looks kind of like a circle or kind of like a square, not like some bizarre species of snake or something like that. But why wouldn't it come down to how you define community? So if there are communities of Latinos in Brooklyn living in swaths of lower-income housing, you know, that kind of go along with the average income of that ethnic group, I realize it's a very overbroad statement, but along those lines, if community is defined by those swaths of housing and the common interests of people who live in those sections of Brooklyn, rather than by just taking, let's say, a nice, comfortable circle in the middle, which has all different kinds of income groups and people with all different kinds of interests.
The circle doesn't have to be unrelated to the reasons for drawing the lines. If there, in fact, are a group that's a homogeneous group of citizens, whether they're all Dodger fans or whatever might be the case, there's nothing wrong with that.
There are no Dodger fans in Brooklyn anymore. They're Nets fans.
Okay, well, I'm
kidding.
You have to forgive me because I'm still a Cubs fan, which is a pretty difficult position to maintain. But really, it isn't that you create the you're just not looking for circles in order to have circles. You're trying to avoid the construction of districts that have no rational justification whatsoever, except to give a partisan advantage to the people who drew the districts. There's a world of difference between that kind of partisan motivation and a neutral approach to districting.
I think Muhammad in Manhattan got to a place where his cell phone won't be breaking up so much, so we'll give him a second chance. Muhammad, you're on WNYC.
Oh, thanks again, Brian. Justice Stevens, sir, it's a huge honor. I am a lawyer in Manhattan, and my question to you is that did you retire, the timing of your retirement, did you retire when you did so that another justice from the Bush administration could not be appointed and the balance in the bench in Supreme Court can be intact?
No, I can answer that very simply. You know, I had health problems that I think made it appropriate for me to step down from the bench. I'm pretty fortunate to still be here now, but it was purely personal and nothing to do with the political situation.
Well, many states have mandatory retirement ages for judges at the state level. Do you think it's a problem that the average age of Supreme Court justices is so high? Critics say, as a body, it can be very out of touch with the contemporary American lives that it's interpreting the Constitution for.
No, I think over the years, the federal judges have done a good job of recognizing when it is appropriate for them to retire. And I retain my belief that a lifetime appointment is the best way to select a good judiciary.
We're just about out of time. But since you mentioned that you're a Cubs fan, one non-Supreme Court question to conclude, if I might. I read on
I was there. And it really happened.
The 1932 World Series game where Babe Ruth called his shot by pointing. Can you recall what you saw of that at bat?
It's kind of a long. The answer is yes. He did point to the bleachers, and he did hit the ball over the scoreboard just as he pointed. I think he was responding to a colloquy with Guy Bush, a member of the Cubs pitching staff, who was not pitching that day. But it's a true story.
Has any player ever done it since?
Not that I'm aware of.
Nor I. John Paul Stevens, retired Justice of the United States Supreme Court, now proposing 6 constitutional amendments to fix 6 major problems in America. The book is called 6 Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. Thank you so much for giving us this time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll check out the Ai Weiwei exhibit in Brooklyn. Stay with us.